We can start. Anyway, so welcome. This is our Boundary Layers meeting.
AKA Paradise.
Boundary Layers in the boundary of the ocean to whatever, California. You know, it's been years that this has been kind of happening. When did we start thinking about this? I mean, they asked 2.5, I think we had to submit the proposal 2.5 years ago. And at the time, I had a very clear vision of what I wanted to do, but all of that stuff has kind of gone through. So now we're in like generation 3, 4, 5 of what this meeting might look like. And especially now that there's so many people who've agreed to come, it's kind of like reworking itself to match what everybody wants to do, what everybody's hoping to get out of it. So basically, thank you all for coming. This will be great. We're going to have lots of time to think and lots of time to learn from each other. And I was going to talk a little bit about the way I think about boundary layers in a little bit, but I thought, and Brad and I both were saying that it was also just a good idea because not everybody knows everybody. So let's go around a little bit first, and we can say just a few words about what we do, what we're thinking about, what we hope to get out of this meeting. So I'm Baylor. For those of you who don't know me, I am an oceanographer, climate modeler, process modeler, do lots of parameterization development for climate models. It's the primary thing that I work on. The primary problem that I have been working on related to this meeting is Langmuir turbulence and submesoscale eddies, both of which live in the ocean boundary layer and affect the air-sea transfers. So, Brad, do you want to go next? If you might have other things to say, too.
I'm Brad Larson. I'm saying that as a theoretical condensed matter physicist, but for the past decade or so, I've been working on fluid dynamics, mainly large-scale planetary astrophysical flows, developing statistical approaches. You'll hear about something done recently tomorrow at the colloquium. And recently I've been working with Baylor and also Steve on trying to develop some more systematic approaches to subgrid scale modeling. I've been coming here to the KIDP since before it was the KIDP, it was originally the Institute for Theoretical Physics since 1992. And I've run a number of programs, once with Steve, and then on the advisory board. So if you have any questions, I mean, you can probably answer them. I hope you enjoy your time here. It's a wonderful resource, and we're really pleased to see it being put to use by sort of the geophysical community, climate community, more and more.
So, hi everybody, I'm Sam Stevenson. I'm actually a new faculty member here at UCSB. I'm based in the Bren School, so I had about a 2-minute commute this morning, which is great. I am interested in large-scale climate variability, so I don't do a lot of boundary layer physics, but Baylor is my advisor, so I'm here to visit and also to learn from everybody. A large interest of mine is understanding El Nino physics, sensor dynamics, and how it responds to both past and future climate change. So one thing I'm getting really interested in now is trying to understand how kind of boundary layer or small scale equatorial processes are relevant to the development of ENSO in various climate regimes, and trying to understand how that might relate to the response to overall 21st century climate change. So I'm really interested in hearing the different perspectives on boundary layer physics and how that might relate to climate problems. So.
Hey, I'm Nick Pizzo. I'm up from the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. I work on a study nonlinear and breaking surface waves. Mostly it's kind of a theoretical approach. I have a little bit of experience with numerics, laboratory and fieldwork, so I'm hoping to kind of learn about the parameterizations people employ and kind of how I can contribute to those types of discussions. So I think that's the main thing I want to get out of it, is kind of going from the small scale processes I think I understand in a very theoretical framework to kind of what's being done computationally and how can we kind of meet in the middle somewhere. Is there some room to contribute there?
Hi, I'm Via Villas-Boas. I'm also at Scripps, but I'm a PhD student there. I also work with surface waves, but I do quite a bit of numerical modeling. And right now I'm focusing on wave current interactions. And what I guess what the part of my research that connects with what people are going to be doing here, I'm also interested in magma turbines and how to parameterize those effects into global climate models.
I'm Leonel Romero. I'm also local. I'm a sophomore researcher here. I work in upper ocean processes, air-sea interaction, wave-current interaction, some submersive scale, some Langmuir. I try to combine field observations and modeling. I'm currently working on the coupling of ROMS and WaveWatch 3, developing a new suite of air-sea coupling modes, and I want to learn from everybody and see what we can do together.
Hi, I'm Dimitri Menemendis. I'm at the Jet Propulsion Lab, just south of here, 2 hours, halfway between Scripps and here. So I guess I was thinking, like, I have 4 children and I want this planet to go on and on and on. And I think you guys must have heard, if you read science fiction, we're going away from planet Earth to a spaceship Earth. And I think in 100 years, if not earlier, we'll need to have much better understanding of how, you know, the consequences of our actions and the way things are put together and run what-if experiments. So what I'm thinking is that, like, in 100 years, we'll have tremendous computational power and we'll be able to have these incredibly accurate representations of the climate system. And I mean, the things that we're doing today that people have been trying to do for the last 30 years, but we're going to be able to do them a lot better with a lot more accuracy, a lot more observations. And, you know, any way that I can kind of help to contribute to keep this planet, oh, not planet, the planet will go whether we're here, to keep the next generations going in a sort of, you know, I mean, I think the chances of us exterminating completely are small, but possible, obviously, but to kind of keep it pleasant. So this is kind of the reason I'm excited to work with Baylor, and you learn more about things that I do, like I've been part of this ECHO project estimating circulation climate of the ocean for past 20 years, and kind of everything evolves from that. So I look forward to chatting more with everyone.
And Dimitri, so I hope that there is some way that we can access the big runs.
Absolutely.
As well.
Yes, I'd love to.
Can you say a couple of words about the LSC 4320?
One of the fun things, I mean, there's like, yeah, I know nothing, but I'm involved in a lot of things. And one of the super fun things that we're doing, so the baseline estimating circulation climate of the ocean is Carl Wunsch's kind of idea of how you should put together models for studying climate as opposed to meteorological events. So it's this attempt to combine observations and the equations that we know of how models behave in a consistent way without, you know, interrupting it every 6 hours or every 12 hours and changing the state without knowing where things came from. So as part of this project, you always kind of have to be thinking about the next, you know, the estimation problem is very expensive, and therefore what we can afford to constrain right now is like a third, you know, 1/3 to 1/6 of a degree, because the estimation problem is very expensive. But let's say 10 years, 15 years down the road, we'll be resolving tides sub-mesoscale eddies and all that stuff. So we prepare the models that ECHO will be using in 10 years or 15 years. And one of the really fun projects I did was to run a 1/48th of a degree global ocean simulation. That's approximately 2.3 kilometers grid spacing at the equator, 1 kilometer in the Arctic, 750 meters around Antarctica. And the cool thing is this now doesn't just have ocean circulation, but it has tides also in it. And this is another colleague of ours at MIT that started this, Brian Arbic. And you end up seeing things that are so much more fun, so much more realistic. And the other thing about the simulation is we save hourly output of all the fields for a full 14 months. So you can go anywhere and sample. And look, it's imperfect, but it is so much better than anything we've had access to before. So think of this as a nature run, and there's been a lot of fun science done with this. I think you've used some of that output. And it's supposed to be available. It's just we haven't. Eric Litzrum just threw a bunch of money at PODAC in preparation for SWOT, sure. And I said, gave them, you take this and make it available. So anybody who wants to use it before we have some way of distributing, just talk to me. I'd love to, you know, cut pieces or get you accounts at SIMC. Sorry.
No, that's great. Thanks, Steve.
Hi, I'm Steve Tobias from the University of Leeds in the UK. I'm interested primarily in geophysical and astrophysical fluid dynamics, in particular like multi-scale processes, turbulence, things that are both multi-scale in space and time. And I'm really here to shamelessly steal all your good ideas. I know nothing about climate. I know very little about the oceans. I know hardly anything about the atmosphere either. So that's a good starting point to try and steal all your good ideas. You have a lot of these things involving statistical mechanics and involving dynamical systems approaches to turbulence. And if I can steal all your good ideas and apply them to astrophysical problems, that would be great. If you want some input from me, I do occasionally have some good ideas of my own, which is how collaborations with Brad and various other people have started. So I'm really happy to chat with you and find out the kinds of problems that you guys are interested in, because I bet that it's very similar to the kinds of problems I'm interested in. I just don't know any of the terminology that you guys use.
Hey everyone, I'm Brett McKim. I'm an undergraduate here, and I've done some work in coastal oceanography, but I haven't done any sort of numerical work or anything like that, and I just kind of wanted to learn more about the field, so I was hoping I'd just stop in on some of the lectures you guys will be having in the next couple months.
Cool.
Seth Boeing, I'm at the University of Leeds as well. I mainly work on moist convection in the atmosphere and how it couples to the boundary layer. So there's two things that I work on. One is parameterization, moist convection and its coupling, and in particular trying to capture the kind of unsteady behavior of clouds and how they interact. And the other thing is very detailed simulations, so large eddy simulations. And one of the things we've recently worked on is a fully Lagrangian parcel-based kind of large eddy model for moist convection that may have some similarities with methods that can also be used in the ocean. So I'm really curious about other people's ideas. One of the things we're struggling with is some quick mixing there. So.
Okay, hi everybody, my name is Ji Liu, I'm from China. I'm a field oceanographer. I was trained by the Russian school and also Steve Salt in the UK, so on small scale turbulence. So over the last 10 years, I've been marrying turbulence in the real ocean. At the beginning, in the bottom boundary layer, in the shelf sea, so it's really tight the bottom boundary layers. And then to the ocean interior to marry in terms of brick-induced mixing. And now I think maybe it's part of the, because I haven't seen the proposal for the data, but I think maybe part of the motivation for this kind of program is, I think traditionally we think the small-scale table, particularly for the upper ocean, 1D, I mean, vertical directions. Now we know that it's horizontal dimension, they couple each other with it. I mean, this some method skills that comfort with working small scale table. I think this is the perfect time to sit together for us to talk about this, I think. For me, I'm more on traditionally small scale table, let's say upper ocean dynamics. But I think now it's a good time for me to learn how people, you know, different theoretical ideas, how, and I know a little bit more about what's happening in the real ocean, because I have been kept marine tables in the real ocean. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
And you now you're where are you located now?
No, I'm based in China. It's Xiamen University. It's Southern China. It's basically a bilateral building in the middle of Taiwan, but we are in the west coast of Taiwan Strait.
Very so cool. Jimbo just says hi. He sent me an email this morning.
He wants to know. We are very good friends. Jimbo.
Yeah.
That was.
I'm Greg Cheney. I'm from the University of New Hampshire. I actually sit in the mechanical engineering department. So I'm sort of a hardcore fluid dynamicist, I guess, by training. But dating back to my PhD days, I worked on Langmuir circulation, so that's how I got into GFD and oceanography and related topics. Because I'm particularly interested in like turbulent instability phenomena at small scales. So Langmuir turbulence, various forms of convection, stratified shear turbulence. And I'm interested in the extent to which you can sort of exploit the coherent structures that emerge from these instabilities to develop rationally simplified descriptions of the phenomenon rather than sort of phenomenological or ad hoc models. And so I think getting to your point, that, you know, one of the dreams I would have starting at the small scales is that one could, you know, sort of rationally couple, you know, develop simplified descriptions that would couple Langmuir turbulence or convection or other in the ocean surface mixed layer with sub-mesoscale dynamics, you know, going out 10 kilometers or even more. I mean, taking some sort of halting, you know, steps in that direction, but, you know, I think everything still needs to be done. So there are interesting hydrostatic, non-hydrostatic couplings that occur there. And I think, you know, applying a systematic mathematical approach offers a sort of more promising way to develop robust parameterizations than sort of just. So that's kind of my angle on things. And I guess two topics I'm excited to maybe learn about, depending on how the program goes, is ice-ocean interactions, although we haven't heard anything about that yet. I don't know much about it. And then also—
What kind of ice?
All kinds. So sea ice, and then where meet the ocean and circulations that are induced. But then also atmospheric moist convection and some, and how it might interact with boundary layers. I don't know anything about that, but I would love to learn more. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Yann Michel. I'm a postdoc from Paris. So I met Greg Chimier last year in a GFD program, and we are working on modeling on stratified trough, and I did a PhD about experiments on surface waves.
So the University of Paris,
jet lagged, but
yeah,
Oh, that's very prestigious.
Did you meet with Stefan Fogg, that you probably know?
No, I don't, but I should.
Well, David, you arrived just in time to introduce yourself. No, although no one else, you don't know who anybody else is, but yes.
He knows. We did.
So my name is David Ferrero. I'm working in Reading, UK. And actually, I don't know, what were you? I like oceans.
Good.
Water, dense water, plenty of water. And I'm mostly doing climate modeling than numerical modeling. I like boundary layers.
And so David is going to give a discussion for us this week, and so we'll have a longer chance to hear what his thoughts are at this stage.
Yes.
So does anybody have any questions about how any of this stuff works, which we can ask Brad since I don't know? So the basic timing of how this is, I tried to explain this in a couple of the emails that I blasted out to everybody, is there's not a whole lot of scheduled activities. There's a lot of discussions. Even the scheduled activities can be framed as discussions. So it's not a conference, you know, 40, 20-minute talks in a row. This is really meant for everybody to develop kind of a deeper understanding of what everybody else is on about. And I hopefully, over the course of this 3 months, will have a better sense of where the holes are, where, you know, important where those pieces should come together. We could draw some things on the board. Maybe let's draw some things on the board. All right, so the way that I was thinking about this, and everybody should interrupt me. Normally when I start teaching, I make a really profound mistake, not on purpose, but just by accident, encouraging the students to interrupt me, but you guys just interrupt me anyway, I'll tell you anyway. Okay, so what are the boundary layers we're thinking about, and how do we think about boundary layers, right? So on the Earth, we're not thinking about the solid Earth boundary layers, although there was a program here a few years back that was on boundary layers in the mantle, which is kind of a cool other thing. But anyway, we'll just draw an ocean floor, and we'll make it go up. And then we put a wavy surface in between. And then we put some kind of stuff, maybe with a dashed line to divide that off, and then another dashed line like this. And then some wavy stuff down here. And then we put another dashed line up here. And then we put some stuff with little puffy clouds on it up here. So, and there are other boundary layers on the top, which I guess we might hear if we have some overlap with the astrophysicists, which would be kind of cool to think about. And then we have maybe an ice shelf, which we can draw like that, with some little icebergs and some sea ice. Okay, so this is kind of the piece. So in a climate model, how do we think about all these things? So a climate model, we have very coarse resolution. So Dimitri just drew out some numbers, but typically we would say something like 1 degree. So climate models, we're talking about 100 kilometer horizontal resolution, roughly. And that would be maybe 200 in the atmosphere, 100 in the ocean, and ice. And the land ice could be higher resolution or could be just totally parameterized or just stuck in as data. So that's the typical one. And the equations we would use there for the ocean anyway would be hydrostatic, Boussinesq. And for the atmosphere, they would be compressible, right? And so that's the basic piece for like the big system into which we're going. So everything we below 100 kilometers, we either have to parameterize or model a different way. So if we did a process model, we might think about doing that. So the mesoscale or submesoscale permitting models like Dimitri's might be 50 times higher resolution. So mesoscale, so that's kind of 2 kilometers or maybe 10 kilometers in that range for the ocean. And in the atmosphere, there are coupled systems which would have maybe a 25 or 50 kilometer atmosphere attached to them. And that's kind of the bleeding edge of what we think the future of climate modeling looks like. Not IPCC AR6, but maybe AR7 or AR8.
So when you say climate, you're thinking of what kind of time scales? 100, 1,000? Because it makes it, I mean, because you're right.
That's a good point.
Right now, it's more like 25 in terms of AR6, right?
Yeah, so the human forecasts tend to look out to 2100. That's kind of the typical formulation, or back to 1900. So we're kind of thinking 100-year timescales in the climate projection world. In the 2-kilometer, 10-kilometer model, we're talking shorter, maybe a few years, maybe a decade. Some of those, there is now a project I've just heard with the new supercomputer at Qingdao to run a model like this for 500 years, which would be the first of its time of its kind in a coupled setting. And so that's kind of the framing of that. But now when we go below the mesoscale, we go down to the submesoscale. So though there is submesoscale permitted at 2 kilometers, if we really want submesoscale resolution for most parts of the world, we're talking about maybe 100-meter grid to, yeah, whatever, 2 kilometers. And so this guy is still hydrostatic Boussinesq in the ocean anyway. And if we were doing mesoscale meteorology, I mean, Steve, you should, we might also use hydrostatic Boussinesq or non-hydrostatic Boussinesq still for doing atmospheric flows on that scale.
Lower layer, you can use Boussinesq, but they could do
an elastic. Elastic, yeah.
Or a smaller domain.
Yeah. Okay. And then when we get to the submesoscale, one way, I mean, the point that Greg made quickly, one way to think about the bottom of the submesoscale for the ocean is where we go non-hydrostatic. So we call that large eddy simulations or boundary layer turbulence, but that's when you're talking about, say, 1 meter 10-meter resolution, and then you're non-hydrostatic by the time you get down here. Okay? So these models are expensive, but they might be focused on this, just this boundary layer, or just this boundary layer, or just a region under the ice, or just around one flow, what's going on in the edges of the flow. So that's kind of the ballpark from the modeling perspective. at least on the ocean side, and a little bit of the atmosphere side. What about the theory side? So, the old-fashioned way of thinking about this.
Sorry, just
yeah.
You went already at this end of the spectrum, but there are many people who are doing paleo climate.
And oh yeah, yeah, yeah. 100
kilometers is high resolution for them.
Paleo, which has, you know, 1,000-year kind of thinking, or 10,000-year, 100,000-year, and there they might have, you know,
2D
or very simplified systems. And that's part of
two observations to fit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just wanted to point out that, like, the paleo people are now at the point where we can do 1,000-year simulations at 200-kilometer resolution.
Yeah.
So, like, that exists. So
right.
We're getting there.
Yeah. 10,000-year even at 3 degrees. Yeah.
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 But you still don't have the flexibility to, when you do something like that, you might want to redo it 10 times. To do glacial interglacial, to do opening of direct passage, and so.
But the last Millennium Ensemble, how many ensemble members are there, Sam?
Now there's, I think, 35.
Yeah.
1,000 years long.
So 1,000 years at, and those are 1 degree or 3 degree?
Or 2 degree.
Two
in
degree.
The atmosphere, one in the ocean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's this, but it's a grand challenge by just having an ensemble and having to be long members. And, yeah, all right. So what about the theory side of things? So in grad school, they said a boundary layer is if you have d by d normal direction and d by d along direction, that d by d normal of whatever was much, much greater than d by d along, right? So that's boundary layer in one sense. You could say that it's really an asymptotic budget on your PDEs. And then, but it's a special kind of asymptotic budget because there's a boundary condition down here. So it's a singular perturbation. This guy, did I do it backwards? Probably. No, I did it right. This guy has to be there even if you might have a small parameter out front because you're satisfying stress boundary conditions, you're satisfying air sea flux boundary conditions, you're satisfying those pieces. So that's one conception of what a boundary layer is. And typically in parameterization world, that might just be bottom drag.
So
or,
I think,
yeah.
Sorry, I'm just slow. Shouldn't they be the other way around? I'm confused. Is that right? So okay.
The derivative across here is this, or the layer is thin. So the change from this side to this side
is
big as a very long distance in this direction.
It's the rate of change.
It has to do it in a very thin way.
So if I had, say, a temperature outside
right.
and a temperature at the wall, the difference here might be pretty big. It would take me a long distance in this direction to reach that same level of temperature distance.
Right. I guess, hear me out for 1 second, I'll say something stupid, but the grad school way of thinking of boundary layer is that within the boundary layer, that's very small. The gradients are very small within the boundary layer, and that's why, for example, KPP invented the non-local transport so you can have transport across a place where df, dn is vanishingly small. I mean, but that's not what happens in real world, but that was kind of the
optimization.
No, I mean, in a sense, what that is that's talking about the solution to an equation like this, right? So if you have a derivative, if you have a small boundary layer and the changes are limited in that direction, you have a governing equation, because your boundary layer is shallow, then you tend to be well mixed in that direction because you're solving an equation which has an asymptotic relationship like this.
Right.
So those terms, these guys being big, this distance being short, tends to push the gradients out of those bits of the budget. So that's another piece we should talk about, which is the next thing I wanted to say was, okay, now parameterization world, not asymptotic theory world, but next piece, boundary layer, mixed layer, mixing layer, surface layer, bottom boundary layer, what do all those things mean? So the way I think of it anyway is there is a mixed layer, which tends to occur on the top and the bottom, which has to do to the, with that response. And it has to do with the turbulent mixing that's here, it's for reasons we're going to talk about in a second. But those, the mixed layer is well mixed only in the vertical of properties that are conserved. There's things like temperature, salinity, or potential temperature, salinity, density, sometimes momentum, though sometimes you can have shear within that layer depending on what kind of a layer it is. If it's an Ekman layer, for example, you might have shear within the layer even though the temperature is well mixed. So how did it get that way? Well, there's turbulence mixing it. And so the mixing layer, not the mixed layer, but the mixing layer or the boundary layer is the place where the mixing is going on. That's where the turbulence lives. That's where the turbulence is energized. So when you take a measurement, you can measure a profile of temperature and say, my mixed layer is from whatever my surface value is until it changes by 0.2 Kelvin in terms of temperature. Or my mixing layer, I could measure the turbulent dissipation rate using a microstructure profiler and say my boundary layer is where 90% of that dissipation exists. Because you'll get a big profile with a lot of turbulent dissipation, you've got a lot big source of turbulence here at the top. Okay? So there's mixed layers. There's mixing layers and or boundary layers. And then sometimes people talk about the mixed layer base, which is normally a jump in stratification. And Steve, stop me if there's a, there probably is an analog going up, which I don't understand as well, right?
Yeah. It's the same in the atmosphere. You typically have a mixed or mixing layer in terms of the potential temperature or virtual potential temperature, and then there's a jump on top, especially for a dry atmosphere. For moist, it's a bit different, but people have been trying to extend the theory for a clumped up boundary layer as well.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, and then we talked a little bit about the boundary conditions. So what are the boundary conditions, though? We have stress boundary conditions. So we might have a no-slip boundary condition at the bottom. We might have a specified stress, an air-c flux of momentum at the top. And or we might have cooling or heating, which if it's cooling, it would generate turbulence. If it's heating, it can suppress turbulence. So there are these funny things, the skin friction velocity, U-star, and the W star, which is just something converted out of buoyancy to have the right unit so that you can add it together to U star, that talks about the amount of cooling or the amount of heating at the surface. And then there are various Langmuir flavors like W star L or the turbulent Langmuir number, which is another, which is a dimensionless piece which allows you to think about how wavy this surface is. Because in the ocean side, the waviness is really important because the waves do stuff. So if this were a rigid boundary with the same stress applied, this goes back, there's an old DeSaro series of papers showing this, you don't get as much, you get more turbulence in the ocean in terms of vertical velocity statistics than you would expect if there was a rigid layer exerting the same stress. So somehow, the waves are making more turbulence up there. Now the somehow is going to be a big part of the pieces that we're going to talk about. There is breaking waves, next stuff. There's Langmuir turbulence, which is maybe most easily defined as the thing which appears in the Craik-Leibovitz equations, which are wave-averaged equations that don't occur with when you turn off the Stokes drift. But then there's something else called non-breaking wave turbulence, which may or may not exist. There's there's a Babin and stuff, which is a whole other thing, but that's different because it is a type of turbulence that's triggered by the phase of the wave. So maybe only under a crest do you see turbulence below. So it doesn't, it may or may not be the same thing as Langmuir turbulence. It's a complicated piece. There's a big mess there. I've been actually emailing with Babin this week trying to sort out where all this lies. All of those pieces are parts of what we parameterize in the ocean boundary layer. and then go back into the climate models.
That's a really tough question.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got this interface. And so you're thinking about the boundary layer. There's processes with certain timescales going on in the ocean.
Yeah.
And processes with different timescales going on. And so what provides a boundary condition for what depends on the importance, the relative importance of those timescales. So what timescale processes are you thinking of happening in the ocean and then in the lower bit in the atmosphere?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the synoptic timescale in the atmosphere is roughly days to weeks. The equivalent, so the mesoscale eddy timescale in the ocean, is months. But then the submesoscale eddies, which are the same dynamics as mesoscale eddies but living only in the boundary layer, have timescales of kind of days.
So for those, it's almost like a couple.
There's a potential frequency resonance, yeah.
But for the other processes, you're thinking of so the ocean having a long timescale compared to the atmosphere. So it provides a boundary condition for the atmosphere, but not the other way around. It's the ocean providing a boundary condition for itself, although it's stressed by the atmosphere as well.
So it depends on where you are. In the tropics, the coupling is. Most of the modes of variability are both atmosphere and ocean modes together.
Okay.
In the extratropics, the traditional understanding is that the atmospheric forcing is high frequency and the ocean response is low frequency. But we have come to understand now that when you get into coupled models of this resolution, the ocean native instabilities actually produce weather systems that match them. So it's a scale selective one in the extratropics. It's probably also scale selective in the tropics. A big difference in boundary layers is the heat capacity of the ocean is enormously large, right? And then particularly because it's not just the surface heat capacity, it's getting recycled. So the mixing time scale, the time scale at which you overturn the boundary layer, is on the order of hours. The eddy turnover time scale for Langmuir turbulence is on the order of 10 minutes to an hour, with similar kinds of time scales for atmospheric overturnings.
Okay. Yeah.
That makes sense?
Yeah.
But Steve, is your point, sorry, can I just ask,
yeah.
This has always kind of bothered me, is that something that's Langmuir, is, you know, I quite happily just say the wind stress is this, and like with no, or people, you know, with no two-way coupling.
Yeah.
But you say the wind stress is this, but there's no turbulent component, so you just take the wind stress.
That's right. That's right. It's not like I'm taking, you know, some atmospheric rolls or.
Right. It's relatively constant, and often the wave field is also taken to be constant because the waves have an enormous amount of energy compared to the turbulence that may or may not be getting produced from it. So, although there's the generalized Lagrangian mean theory, which says that you can't actually do anything to the turbulence unless you extract some energy from the waves or subtract some pseudo-momentum from the waves. So there are these coupled pieces which come into figuring that piece out. I hope we'll have people coming, Frank Bryan and some other folks, who are really focused on that upward-downward coupling at the mesoscale. So that's going to be something we'll get to probably in May. We'll have a bunch of people who want to talk about that side of things. So that'll get more into the nitty-gritty. Missed anything? Dimensionless parameters? I don't know. I guess dimensionless parameters. When does rotation get important? When does rotation stop being important? So you could say Rossby number. So Rossby number here, so that's right, U over FL. So the Rossby number is a lot less than 1 here. It is 1 here. And it's way, way, way bigger than 1 here. That's one way to think of it. The Richardson number, so stratification to shear. So the Richardson number in the climate system, the deep ocean, the total ocean, is very, very large.
That's
you know, climate length scales and the horizontal or the full depth of the ocean, either way you want to think of it.
Yeah.
When you get into the mesoscale, it's still large. So the quasi-dystrophic theory is essentially this and this together. When you get here, the Richardson number is order 1. And when you get here, the Richardson number is maybe between a quarter and 0, if you want to think of it that way. So one way to think of the submesoscale is where both of these, so the submesoscale is kind of a nightmare because it's the place where nothing is asymptotically gone except for non-hydrostatic effects. It's the whole, all of the terms in the equation are the same size.
But for the LES, you're thinking stratified but non-rotating, essentially.
Yes, although because the mean field sets up, the rotating you might get an Ekman layer, which serves as the background shear field, which really changes the flavor of LES, depending, even though in asymptotically the turbulence we're thinking about, not the mean domain average stuff, doesn't care about rotation, the background flow does. One other piece, I guess, which I was going to put in, is how do we define these guys? Is a big nightmare, observationally.
After the question, Reynolds numbers?
What? Oh, Reynolds numbers? They're all huge.
Okay.
Yes. Even at this scale, they're 10 to the 4, I guess, would be. So we use large eddy simulations here. DNS would be, Nick, have you done DNS?
I've collaborated with people who have done DNS.
So how big is the domain, like 10 centimeters, kind of?
You can make, that was like 5 years ago. So my colleague, Luke Dyke, is now at Princeton. He runs DNS of 2D focusing waves, and it's basically a numerical wave tank, and it's 30 meters long.
Yeah.
And that's state of the art. And that's using Stefan Popinay's code Jaris, which is an adaptive grade solver.
So 2D, you can do kind of 30 meters by whatever.
It's a meter deep, and you have another meter in the air.
And that's free surface too, right?
Yep.
So LES we normally think of as maybe a couple hundred meters domain in the horizontal and 50 meters in the vertical kind of scale is typical. That's easy to run. That's like something we could choose to do and get a result by tomorrow kind of thing. Big calculations on this end are the ones where you try to do this one together with this one.
Yeah.
And that's Greg and I collaborated on a project where we did a few of those, and that's kind of 10 million CPU hour kind of scale. So that's the big one on those end. I don't know. So where are the pieces? So I guess the only thing we haven't talked about are the questions, and maybe, which is maybe, what do we want out of this mess? So, you know, where do we want to go? So in my group, we tend to think about parameterizations to go in here, which usually involves messing around with all this stuff in order to put something back into there. But that's not the only target, and Dimitri, we've talked about, you know, what are the parameterizations in here? How do you think about this? Do you have to change them when you start going non-hydrostatic, even if you're not resolving the non-hydrostatic modes? There's a whole zoo of instabilities here beyond the mixed layer instabilities that we know how to parameterize, sort of. There are deficiencies in the parameterizations of mixed layer instabilities here that we certainly can talk about, and there's lots of publications coming out on that kind of stuff. I don't know. So, I mean, I guess the big science questions for me are, what are the pieces that where do we know? So what are successful ways to think about how we build a parameterization? So there is a thread that Brad and Steve have been on with a kind of StatMac approach to that. There's Stephen Belcher's approach, which is kind of an energy budget kind of approach. There's a second moment closure approach, which Ramsey Harcourt has been doing a lot of recently, so he's going to come and talk about that. There's KPP, which, you know, McWilliams will be here next week talking about that. Those are the flavors of boundary layer parameterizations of the small-scale turbulence. The submesoscale turbulence, we have only naive notions about how to do that, but at least there's some parameterizations of a few flavors of those. They haven't been tested very thoroughly, some of them. So that's an interesting place for thinking about things. So I guess there's one science question is, how do we think about this? What does it mean to think about these problems? Are we trying to work on parameterizations? Are we trying to understand the processes? Are the processes different depending on horizontal scale, which I've laid out they are, for sure, but how do we think about them, rather than just the 1D or isotropic 3D that is then being interpreted as 1D in these models? Yeah.
So, I mean, this is kind of like my super naivete. I mean, I rely on you guys to tell me about that, but one thing that is happening is that most of the parameterizations we've used in the climate models are pushed properties down gradient. And I guess, you know, now we're starting to do these computations even at the 2 kilometer, and things are mostly not going down gradient most of the time in very large ways. And are your parameterizations, and I mean, first of all, what is the consequence for climate models if you're using down gradient parameterizations, because they're easy and they're Fickian or whatever the word is? What's the consequence of the fact that most of the time, a lot of places in the ocean, things go up gradient because of restratification, because of, front. So that's something I'd like to get out of this 2 months here from
absolutely
you guys.
So that's a classic problem of astrophysics as well. I mean, most of your processes are up gradient. So how do you?
Then what?
Then what?
So this guy and this guy are up countergradient in the vertical because they're extracting potential energy. So they tend to put the dense stuff down and the light stuff up. But they tend to be relatively downgradient in the horizontal, with a few exceptions around frontal structures. We haven't talked about fronts. We will talk a lot about fronts before we are through. But those are, and there's going to be a whole lot about fronts. So that's not going to be unavoidable. This guy, there are some aspects of which are down gradient, but then one of the big distinctions among the parameterizations is the non-local fluxes and KPP. So those are not down gradient. Those are just from the surface to depth. And they don't depend on the intermediate gradients as they're dropped off. So this is one of the...
Non-local, you mean non-local in space or non-local in wavelength space?
Non-local in the vertical space.
In actual physical
space. Yeah, physical space. So they have a diffusivity and a viscosity, and then they also have a non-local flux. So the total flux is a combination of a down gradient part and another part, which has its own independent rules.
So this kind of comes back to my confusion with this DF, DN. Mm-hmm. Like the way I guess that you think about a mixed layer is that DF, DN is zero within the mixed layer. However, we know that there's stuff that goes from the surface to below the mixed layer, which is due to entrainment processes, for example. And that you know, one way to get around that in the climate type of simulation is these non-local transport. Now, I have to admit that in the 2 kilometer simulation, I have to turn that term off. I don't know why, but it made the model blow up. And maybe that's another thing I should find out.
These are among the things. There are also some real, so I think, you know, there's a lot to think about in practice side of how these pieces that we have, how well they work. So the parameterizations in climate models more or less agree, because they're all have kind of the same non-dimensional parameters driving them. The differences between them are kind of second order corrections. So neglecting Langmuir turbulence is about a 10%, 20% change to boundary layer depth. Neglecting some mesoscale stuff is about the same size. So we don't have, and we will have to think about how to start doing discussions about what the basics are, the pieces that we all think they all agree on, but the kind of U star, W star scalings and that stuff, we want to be sure that we're not reinventing those wheels. That stuff, going back to Monin and Nabokov, like there are dimensional analysis pieces of the story that we probably should be thinking about first. These are second order effects in some sense that we're thinking about. plus the practicality side.
Yeah. So in terms of practicality, I want to just throw one more thing on the table is, when do you turn these on, when do you turn them off? I mean, that's the unfortunately what happens is a lot of the times we are in a regime where we're partly resolving certain things, but not fully.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's some school of thought that say, well, if you're partly resolving something, you're not resolving them at all, and therefore you should fully parameterize them. But then that's kind of boring. For example, if you go for mesoscale eddies, if you want to have eddy kind of stuff in your model, you can't parameterize them, because if you parameterize them, you smooth them out. However, there's people saying, well, if you don't fully resolve them, you should parameterize them. So when do you turn these parameterizations on and off on a practical?
Another one of our participants who's here but not at this meeting is Scott Bachman, who's been doing a lot of work on that for both symmetric instability parameterizations and mesoscale parameterizations, and has been thinking a lot about how you formulate that, those kind of switches on and off in the dimensionless number space. Sort of how you diagnose on the fly what scales are relevant, which ones you're resolving, how the numerics interface with that, because it depends on your numerics. So that's definitely a piece of the story. The other part we haven't mentioned yet is wave modeling, which I'm looking at Leonel, might also be, traditionally, outside of the DNS case, we don't resolve those waves in these models. So what does that mean for all of this stuff? It means that we're not really imposing the right surface boundary conditions, we're imposing some approximation to them. It's normally like a wave averaged version. And it means that we don't have the, if turbulence is actually oriented in certain phases of the wave, like breaking waves obviously are, but also this non-breaking wave turbulence would be as well. Those are pieces of that story. The Craik-Leibovitz equations are a wave averaged version, which have flaws because of exactly that. The waves that, even when we do model waves, we're still extremely limited in the way that we treat them, because we tend to do simplifications by just having them be a spectrum with a particular spectral slope beyond a certain frequency cutoff. They're nonlinear interactions. The wave-wave interactions are relatively simplified. The way that the surface stresses, both upward and downward, get transformed into growth on particular wavelengths are also really simplified. So we'll have a bunch of wave modelers coming throughout the program. People like Luigi Cavallari will be here. So folks who really understand that side of stuff, which will be part of the discussion as we go along. So I don't want to leave that off, even though right now there's only one climate model in the world for AR6 that has waves in it, and it's because my group put it in. So that's one, but there are other ones that are thinking about it, and so we'll see.
What do you mean by wave model? You have a wave model which is coupled
is part of the coupled system.
Oh, okay.
No, so in addition to atmosphere and ocean and sea ice, we have waves.
Yeah, yeah.
So the waves presently only drive Langmuir turbulence, but we're experimenting now with coupling it to sea ice, so you can break up waves in the marginal ice zone. So in the sea ice world, there's like solid flows, there's ice shelves, there's marginal ice, there's pancake ice, there are all these different kinds, and some of them are really sensitive to the waviness, some of them are sensitive to the ocean temperatures, some of them are sensitive to the atmospheric temperatures. So when we get some more ice people in, we'll get a sense of what that stuff is about, even though we probably could have done this whole meeting on just polar oceans and not had enough time to talk about it, since it's really complicated. Yeah.
I don't know if this is related or not, but I was wondering whether you have anybody here who's interested in like land atmosphere boundary interactions, because there's a lot of like gravity, weight, drag, and things like that that are important.
So yeah, we do have a few people. Belcher's done a lot of stuff on that. And Steve, have you done stuff on rough topography, kind of downward over?
Yeah. Topography is important. Canopies is an interesting one as well. It can get waves there as well.
So yeah, canopies and urban landscapes, and there are a bunch of different pieces on that stuff. So I think that at least touches on everybody who's coming somehow. Where the different theories are, where the different needs are, where the different questions are, I think is what we have a few months to think about, sort out.
Just a remark about parameterization. People have tried to start to do that with clouds in the atmosphere. We have a 2D in within, what's the name?
Superparameterization.
Thank you, yeah. There are a few examples, there are very few examples in the ocean, no? I can only think of a handful, and they were not about boundary layer as far as they were about deep convection.
Yeah, did you guys ever, you did, yeah, like with Malacca, yeah.
It's a highly idealized situation, but basically it's morally akin to superparameterization, but I like to think it was on a slightly firmer mathematical basis, but regardless, it was an attempt to do that, to get out to the submesoscale. But, it was like 2D, three component, it was highly idealized in all these ways. We were just trying to see if we could do it. And the other paper, though, I think Camden, who's that MIT?
Jean-Michel, yeah.
Yeah, they a long time ago.
It was deep convection and internal waves. Oh, okay. And it was still a 2D.
Sorry, it wasn't boundary layer, sorry. It was convection.
But I'm not able to think of a real application.
Love or hate superparameterization, I think that is an important challenge. So how would you develop schemes, the algorithms that could do that coupling?
So does everybody know what superparameterization is? This is where you do, so you might be running a model at one resolution, and then periodically, every so often, you spin off another high resolution process model, get an answer, and then stick it back in the big one. So maybe at each grid point, maybe just with some definition of where the grid points, like where they're systematically different. But it's avoiding doing a parameterization, which is a closed set of equations. It's instead a closed dynamical system that provides the fluxes you want back. It can be done cleanly with asymptotic mathematics for some of the situations that occur, but not all of them. And so it's a, yeah. It's very dirty in the code, the way it has been done so far, because you have kind of, it's like the climate models are coupling atmospheres and oceans and whatever. This is now coupling on top of that, like a cloud resolving process model that gets called whenever there's a certain kind of clouds they don't know what to do with, and then it does a little calculation and then answers back.
And I hate to beat a dead horse, but I think that's where having some kind of systematic mathematical foundation, gives you a chance to build algorithms that you have some faith in will, robustly do the right thing.
Yeah.
I think Matthew Schneider will probably talk about that. At the conference, or maybe we can get him to come up separately.
To touch on that, Tapio and Shoal were also coming. One of the things they've been talking about, we'll see, and Ralph Ferrari, is all the climate models we have, we should throw them in the trash and start fresh.
Start fresh with machine learning. Yeah, exactly. There's that.
And do something that I think it's useful to actually at least think about that, and there's probably going to be some money, at least JPL, Caltech, and private thing thrown at it, where you try to do things again in a different way, where observations and data simulation are kind of incorporated in the way you think about the models, and where the rather than thinking of the model separately, now these are all the words they've used, and I think they can, I'm not going to say them right. Instead of thinking of the components separately, you're thinking them as a system and about the interactions a lot more.
And I think the other piece, the other side of that coin, the one that I think is actually, an important thing that we don't like to do because it's really dirty, is okay, we've got parameterizations. They sort of work. If we really go after building them right, we get a better answer. But that's not glamorous work. And so one of the big problems we have is we have things that are kind of half-cocked. And, you know, oh, they do something, and look, it sort of works. And now, you know, we do some very casual evaluation of how well it's working. And then that goes in some fraction of the models. So a big piece, a big opportunity is to just go back and say, okay, we've already got KPP, let's make KPP work right. And so some of the discussions we're going to have are going to be along that line, which is the opposite end of let's throw it all away and start from scratch because this is a simple problem, or this is a really hard problem. There's real engineering work to get done to make this very complex system behave the right way. So those are kind of the two ends of that spectrum. Yeah.
Can I make a suggestion? Because one of the things that's been really useful at previous KITP programs I've been involved with is to, because you've got all this community together, is to think of problems you would like to do that perhaps if you're talking about parameterizations, you might say, Greg's point about having a firm mathematical footing is, look, if your parameterization can't get this problem correct, where you know where you can actually do the problem, then you know, let's start thinking again about that parameterization. So if it, as a community, one can come up with a range of problems that investigate certain processes, that's really useful for the community.
Yeah. No, absolutely. So my student Ching, who's coming, has been working on this since he defended his PhD 2 weeks ago. But he's actually been working on it for a few months before. We have a set of a few hundred LES of boundary layers under force, under various forcing conditions. So we have all of this second moments saved, at least. And we have forcing, global forcing, air-sea fluxes, a wave model that's run with the same air-sea fluxes, a cutting-edge wave model, so we have all the wave statistics as well. And he's in the process of collecting Argo profiles that are repeating so that we have initial conditions. So to have global targets for this is what the boundary layer is like, this is what it's doing in the real world, this is what real world forcing looks like, that's one of the pieces. I think that there's a similar movement afoot in the polar side to have some pieces like that. I don't know about the atmospheric side. I don't know whether that's even a comparable target, since there are more observations in the atmosphere. So it's kind of reanalysis targets are maybe a little easier to think about.
One of the things people have been thinking about is even running LES on a single site, and you want to have something that is kind of homogeneous.
Yeah.
So just running an atmospheric LES for a full year, and comparing these small scale statistics.
Yeah.
You know, something similar has been done for the ocean. They can have a site where you bring your smallest scale model with a couple to.
There are a couple of locations in the world. There was the Osmosis mooring setup. So Steve Belcher was the lead on that. So this is a nested set of 9 moorings that were left out for a year. And so they measured all of the upper ocean turbulence and deepening and shallowing in the mixed layers and submesoscale horizontal gradients for a year. There's the Southern Ocean Flux Station, which Peter Sullivan, who's coming, has run year-long LES trying to simulate using the observed air-sea fluxes at that location in the Southern Ocean. And then there's some stuff from PAPA, Ocean Weather Station PAPA in the North Pacific, which has similar year-round forcing, which we've been messing with looking at how the different parameterizations work on it. But it's different between parameterizations and LES. So I think we have more questions than answers, which is good. I think that's maybe where we should be, given that we're just getting started. Yeah.
I know it's theoretical physics, but should we talk about observations?
Yeah, so
a posteriori to figure out if it's true what we said.
Yeah, no, and this is difficult. I think this is difficult in the context of this meeting. I have been trying very hard to get observationalists to come and to bring data sets and stuff, and this is actually, so Bia, you have some linkages up. So I think we have second-hand observations that we're bringing rather than getting the observationalists who are collecting them in person to talk to us about them. But we definitely want to think about what there are and what's missing.
I'd love to find out what you guys think is missing, especially since I'm from NASA.
You know,
what we could observe globally from satellites.
I'd love to.
Yeah, so Daria, another one of the coordinators, and Dimitri, yeah, she is eventually, not at the moment, but in a bit. So yeah, there's another thread is what can be done from satellites. So there's a satellite side, there's Argo, which, you know, on the ocean side has a lot of, and then there are these permanent flux stations, which we can grab the data from for sure.
Looks like people have already cool stuff from gliders too.
Yeah. I don't know about gliders getting up into the surface boundary layer very often, and they definitely don't get in the bottom boundary layer very often.
No.
Bottom boundary layer stuff.
When they do, they stay there.
Yeah, they do, but they don't. They didn't. I don't know. Generally, their CTVs are not sensitive enough to get much measurements up to the top.
Plus, like, there's the time scale for the dive. It's quite long.
So. Yeah, they have a hard time measuring even sub mesoscale. Yeah.
Seas.
But there are more. Accurate measurements at the sea surface are difficult. I mean, getting that first meter is really, really tough. I went on a flip a few times to just aid in this kind of pursuit, and it's kind of the Wild West of parts of oceanography, and we're still sorting out the basics. So, the global stuff you just have to take with a grain of salt.
Is flips still alive? I have read that they were going to.
They've been threatening it for years.
Oh, they've been threatening.
Tom has been threatening to leave the chief engineer.
He doesn't have an engine. How could it die?
Well, so he's not the captain because it doesn't have an engine. He's the chief engineer. But the problem is there aren't many people who know how to operate it. So
Tom, who has been threatened?
Tom, I don't know. He's got a Greek last name. I don't know what it is. But he's the chief engineer. He's 72. He's been running it for 35 years. There's some issues with who's managing FLIP and things like that. So, but the French apparently are building a FLIP too, but in the ACC. So,
and there are some new pieces, video of the surface. There are a bunch of ships that have that now, and autonomous little kayaks and things. So there are some really new platforms of near surface measurements. We can try
and LiDAR stuff. Yeah, it's really amazing too. And the wavefinders.
And the Lagrangian drifters at the surface. So Carter Ullman is a Lagrangian guy, but there are a bunch of Joe Cases coming for a little bit. So we are going to have some Lagrangian folks as well. So horizontal surface drifters, but also three-dimensional Lagrangian stuff. There's a new movement afoot to do everything in three-dimensional Lagrangian, which from a modeling perspective sort of makes sense, but it's a complication. But there's a lot of interesting theory around that we can hash out if people want to, which relates to generalized Lagrangian mean, what you mean by the mean, which is a trick. Yeah.
So I did my PhD in a group that actually tried to use acoustic methods to probe these processes.
Yeah.
David Farmer group at University of Victoria. So they had actually one of my PhD buddies was using something that at the time we were switching from using cards, IBM cards, to terminals. So we had these boxes full of cards.
Throw them
overboard and take movies. So there are, I mean, I don't know how I haven't followed, but I don't know how these acoustic kind of efforts are.
Yeah, the acoustic, the subsurface ones are tricky. They don't have very many drifters, but we just did a similar thing to that with bamboo plates, looking at them from a blimp. So those are statistics, and they have Foreman Lang mirror windrows, which is cool. I don't know. The other piece, the other satellite piece we have is, so Fabrice Arduin is coming, who is the lead of the SeaSkim mission, which is one of the problems with the air-sea fluxes is you don't know what the waves are at the same place as the winds, at the same place as the currents. So this is a radar-based technology to do that all co-located at the same place. Yeah.
Shall we spend a few minutes talking about organization?
Sure.
We only have this room until 11.
Yeah, no, that's good.
So there are three different programs that are running at the same time here. Right now, there's a program that's just ending up this week on solid mechanics, basically. And there's a program that's just started on high energy physics. And when the solid mechanics one is finished, what's the title?
Dense suspensions.
It'll be replaced by dark matter. So the other two programs are not very closely related to ours, unfortunately. We have to interact with them to some degree. So one way we're going to interact with them is that we have a Blackboard talk that we're going to be, someone is going to be giving by Baylor or Jim on May 7th, and everyone is expected to go to the Blackboard talks. And we're expected, of course, to go to their Blackboard talks. So you'll get emails from that director, Lars, urging you to attend the Blackboard talks. And they're actually, they're very good. Because the speaker has to use only the Blackboard, it forces them to be accessible. So,
or totally obscure.
So we have, this room is kind of our room, pretty much, it sounds like. And so Monday, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays, we have it from 10 to 11:30 right now, except for today, we have a special situation. And Thursdays, it's from, 2 to 3:30, was it? Or 1:30 to?
I don't remember.
We'll find out. I think it's 2 to 3:30. And then Fridays, I believe it's 12:30. We can use these times for whatever, as Baylor said, we're mainly not going to have formal presentations, because that's just not both style here, but more like what we just did here. We may have a discussion later, but then the idea is that everyone will contribute, or everyone has something to say. Let's see, there's also the physics colloquium, which is on Tuesdays at 4 p.m. Over in the physics building, which is a block away or so. And we're reminded that there's a physics colloquium is that we don't have cookies on those days, because the cookies are over in physics. But otherwise, there's usually cookies here and a coffee at around 3 p.m. Right across the way. So that's a good place to meet people in the other programs and also just to socialize. Then there's the conference. So that's the one kind of traditional sort of meeting that we have. Not all programs have conferences, but ours does, the week of May 21st. And so if you're here, you'll be going to it, surely. But if you're not here, if you've already left, you can come back if you want. And so we have a bunch of invited speakers, and we may also draw from some of the program participants and as speakers. There's also going to be a poster session. So, and when the conference is held, this partition disappears, and there's a big auditorium over here. And so there'll be a lot of people conference. You want to talk about social?
Yeah, so there's a social coordinator and there's a dinner, which I'm contemplating hosting, which are the two social activities for the week. Right. So someone needs to be a social coordinator, and I was instructed that it is not allowed to be me. So but the idea is it's preferably somebody who's staying in the residence or who is interested in organizing things in the residence. The residence has, it's easy to do barbecues over there, there are communal kitchens, it's easy to do dinners and stuff.
James Brill will give us a tour, the social organizer, a tour of the kitchen facilities and how to use them, the barbecues and so on. I guess it could be more than just one person if you want to explain.
But if anybody is feeling like that's something that they might be interested in doing, now is your time to volunteer.
Let us know.
Yeah, and it's not. This is not implying that you're going to kind of like carry on and plan everything every time. It's more just that you have a person who invites other people to do it and kind of knows what the rules are and how it works, and then makes, you know, kind of keeps it happening. But they don't have to be the one who's like putting away the recycling every time, which is not the, that's not the intention.
In the past, I don't know if we're still doing, KFGB still does this, but we have like a beach party at some point, and the different programs will field soccer teams.
Hi!
And the geophysics climate ones all is one, so
there's soccer. Good, good. Surfing one, yeah. We should have a surfing contest. I think we'd have a good advantage in that one too.
I go for soccer.
So I'm going to volunteer to lead some hikes. I do a lot of hiking, and I've been in many of the trails back here. Unfortunately, some of the nicer ones were destroyed by the fire and the subsequent flash flooding, but there's still some nice ones out there. So you'll be hearing from me about that. And there's, for those of you who are new to this area, I highly recommend just walking along the shore out here, out to the Point, Campus Point. It's really wonderful, and you'll see some of the oceanography stuff out there, and you'll see surfers, and so.
And I was going to probably do some sailing, so if people want to go sailing, it was going to rent boats out of the harbor and Santa Barbara a couple times. So they have J24s that are easy to rent, so we can bring 5 or 6 people easily enough. So that's another thing to do.
Right now, the gray whales are migrating. Mm-hmm. We saw one from the KIDP last week, and the reports are that from the whale watchers that there are lots of mothers and calves right now. Yeah. So this is a good time to go out and see them.
Dolphins are whales.
Oh yeah. I think the only last thing is that Brad and I are right next to the bubble upstairs. We're at 2512. So if you want, if you have any questions, come find us up there.
You know,
thanks, Sam.
No.